listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of our cover story and feature on Barbara Streisand. The Way We Made, The Way We Were by Barbara Streisand. It was the producer, Ray Stark, who initially asked Arthur Lawrence to write something for me. Arthur told me that Ray was impressed with the huge success of The Sound of Music and The Miracle Worker, and thought, why not combine the two and have me teaching handicapped children in Brooklyn to sing? Arthur wasn't enthusiastic about that idea, to say the least, but he came over to discuss it with me. I liked it even less, but as we were talking, the subject turned to politics. Arthur knew I was politically active, and as I was ranting about the state of the world, suddenly he was reminded of a very smart girl he knew in college, who came from a lower-middle-class family and was president of the Young Communist League. Her name was Fanny Price. Funny coincidence, or was it a sign? He said she was intense, passionate, and Jewish like you. Arthur went home and wrote a treatment, and as soon as I read it, I thought, holy mackerel, this is fantastic. I absolutely fell in love with the story. This girl, Katie Morosky, touched me profoundly. She was passionate about life and concerned about the world. I understood her completely. I knew why she fell in love with Hubble Gardner, the good-looking jock, who was also a gifted writer. I read somewhere that David Lean said if you had five great scenes in a script, it could make a great movie. Well, there were definitely five in The Way We Were, so I called Ray, very excited, and said, I love it. I think Arthur was the one who suggested Sidney Pollack to direct. He told me that Sidney was an actor himself and had taught acting in New York at the Neighborhood Playhouse. I thought, great, he'll be sensitive to the actor's process. I had seen his movies, The Slender Thread and They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, which showed he could handle serious issues. So I encouraged Ray to hire him. And I had a particular actor in mind for Hubble, Robert Redford, who happened to be good friends with Sidney, so everything seemed to be falling into place. Many people first noticed Bob in Barefoot in the Park, but that didn't make much of an impression on me. It was a light comedy, and he was perfectly passable. It was only when I watched him in This Property is Condemned, which Sidney directed, that I saw there was a lot going on behind those crystal blue eyes. I was drawn to him, not because of his appearance. Guys with blonde hair and blue eyes were never my type. I did think he was very handsome, a wonderful jawline, great teeth, but what intrigued me most about Bob was his complexity. You never quite know what he's thinking, and that makes him fascinating to watch on screen. Like the greatest movie stars, Bob understands the power of restraint. You're never going to get it all, and that's the mystery. That's what makes you want to keep looking at him. Bob is that rare combination, an intellectual cowboy, a charismatic star, who is also one of the finest actors of his generation. But like my husband, he's almost apologetic about his looks, and I liked that about him. So I wanted Redford for Hubble, but he turned it down. Since Sidney and Bob were so close, my best hope was that Sidney could somehow persuade him. I have to give Sidney credit. He was as persistent as I was, because we both felt that only Redford would make the picture work. It's like playing tennis. I knew my own game would go up when I was opposite a strong player. But Bob was concerned that the script was so focused on Katie that Hubble's character was underdeveloped. He was right. Bob asks Sidney, "Who is this guy? He's just an object. He doesn't want anything. What does this guy want?" In Bob's opinion, he was shallow and one-dimensional, not very real. A pin-up girl in reverse, as Sidney put it. I wanted Bob to be happy, so I told Sidney, give him anything he wants, write more scenes to strengthen his character, make it equal. So Sidney hired two excellent writers, David Raphael and Alvin Sargent, to beef up Bob's part and go deeper beneath that golden boy exterior, and I told Ray to pay him whatever he wanted. But Bob's answer was still no. I was heartbroken. Ray was pressing us to move on and hire someone else. Apparently, he thought any blonde actor would do, and Ryan O'Neill was next on his list. Sidney kept begging for another week to work on Redford. I told Ray to give it to him and kept praying. The negotiations went down to the wire. I was in the middle of filming Up the Sandbox in Africa, and one day I got a telegram from Sue Mingers that simply said, Barbara Redford. That's when I knew he'd finally said yes, and I was so thrilled. The courtship had been tough, but Bob's reluctance had a big influence on the script, and ultimately resulted in a richer, more interesting character. Hubble and Katie were different, very different. He was the fair-haired, taciturn wasp, with no particular political bent, and she was the dark-haired, outspoken Jewish girl with strong anti-war opinions. The script was built on the idea that opposites attract, and that was true. Bob and I were genuinely curious about each other, and I believe that's what comes across on the screen. Once he asked me about Brooklyn. What was it like growing up there? I guess he thought I was kind of exotic, but to me, he was the exotic one, growing up in sunny California. Did he surf, fish, swim in the ocean after eating? I knew he did other daredevil things, like skiing. To come down a mountain on two thin blades, very fast, that's not one of the skills you acquire on the streets of Flatbush. But I would listen to him talk about where he had gone skiing over the weekend, and his descriptions were so evocative, standing alone at the top of a mountain, surrounded by the beauty of the wilderness. It was a little scary, but it sounded good, and I thought, gosh, could I ever do that? He really inspired me to learn how to ski, not something I would normally do. You could break bones. Bob has always been kind of a loner, and that's part of his charm. I'm not big on casual socializing either. This was a story about two people who were aware of each other but moved in different circles, and I think Bob and I made an instinctive decision not to spend too much time together at the beginning. We wanted the discovery process to happen on screen. We shot the movie in sequence for the most part, which is a great gift to an actor. Then, by the time Katie and Hubble were comfortable with each other, so were we. At one point, when we were filming scenes on the beach in Malibu, Bob appeared on his motorcycle and asked me if I wanted to take a ride. Now, I'm not the kind of girl who always dreamed of racing down the road on a bike, hair flying in the wind. You get knots. I got on behind him and held on to his waist for dear life. But oddly enough, once we got moving, I wasn't scared at all. I felt perfectly safe with him. I had no idea where we were going. I remember that we went through a tunnel and then rode up into a canyon I never knew existed, to this mysterious place dense with old oak trees. We crossed over a stream, and the air smelled of wild fennel. It felt as if we were way out in the country, far from civilization, very private. It was great fun to work with Bob. He and I had a real rapport, and the audience could sense it. It's hard to explain why a certain combination of two actors works, but in one interview, Bob tried. Barbara, her femininity brings out the masculinity in a man, and her masculinity brings out a man's femininity, vulnerability, romanticism, whatever you want to call it. No wonder I liked him. He's very perceptive. Before I began to write this chapter, I watched the movie again for the first time since 1998. That's when I got involved in a documentary about the making of the film, a special feature called Looking Back that was part of the 25th anniversary DVD. Sidney, Arthur, and I were each interviewed, and I was surprised to hear Sidney say that Bob and I worked very differently, that I wanted to rehearse a scene over and over, while Bob just wanted to do it. I don't remember it like that at all. I never like to rehearse too much. Often my best performance is the first take. It's the most spontaneous, the most original, and the last thing you want is to lose that spontaneity with too many rehearsals. The audience can tell when an actor is truly thinking, feeling, reacting. It's impossible to fake an emotion when your face is in close-up on a screen 20 feet high. The camera sees right through to the truth. When you pay attention and really listen, that comes across. And in my opinion, that's the secret of great acting. Bob and I are both good listeners, and we had to listen closely because neither of us ever knew exactly what the other was going to do. We played off each other in a wonderful way because we both believed in the importance of being in the moment. You can see that in a scene near the beginning of the film when Katie spots Hubble 7 years after they graduated from college asleep on his stool at the bar in El Morocco. He's a vision in his crisp white Navy uniform, and he takes her breath away. Bob had the shock of hair that fell over his forehead, and as we did the scene, it seemed perfectly natural for me to brush it back from his eyes. It wasn't in the script. It was just something I felt like doing in the moment. It was so intimate coming from me, Barbara, and yet totally right for Katie, too. It's probably something she's wanted to do since their days in college, but never dared. Now he's fast asleep on a bar stool, so what the hell? When I saw the way people reacted to it in dailies, everybody loved it, I decided I should find a few more times in the story where I could repeat it. I'm always thinking of the piece as a whole. It's a physical gesture that brings us closer together, and it might mean something later on. It works kind of like a memorable melody in a great score. All of a sudden, the music comes in, and you don't have to say anything. It's Pavlovian. The feeling is there automatically. That seems to be the gesture that everyone remembers. In fact, Katie Couric even asked me to do it to her when I appeared on her talk show decades later. It just shows you how a spontaneous gesture derived from the truth of the moment can really resonate. We started shooting in September 1972 at Union College in Schenectady, New York. I was 30 years old, Bob was 36, and we were supposed to be in our early 20s, but no one objected. If the story is strong and the actors are good, the audience suspends disbelief. For the first few weeks, a parasite I had contracted in Africa was still bothering me. I had a constant headache, and I found it hard to focus. Everything was hazy and surreal. I couldn't keep food down. I was so skinny, my legs looked like toothpicks. David Rayfield had a house near the college and invited me to stay with him while we were shooting. But I said no, because I could sense his attraction to me, and I didn't want to get involved. I can't deal with a new relationship and work at the same time. He was very attractive, 6'3", with thick salt and pepper hair, a handsome face. A sweet man and a wonderful writer who sent me the most beautiful letters. But I backed away. Perhaps it was because he was too nice, and at that time I was not interested in people who were too fond of me. It was one of my problems. I was drawn to men I couldn't have. Let me be clearer about that. I was still working out issues surrounding my stepfather. Even though his name was Lou Kind, he was anything but. David, on the other hand, was really kind and thoughtful, so he didn't fit my familiar pattern. And he was totally available, so he didn't present enough of a challenge, I guess. Too bad. I adored David as a person. We remained friends for the rest of his life, and I didn't want to hurt him. I'll bet that was another reason why I was so queasy during that first month. Back to the movie, I really identified with Katie, and it was interesting how many pieces from my own closet also worked for her. That's my vintage brown skirt and tortoiseshell necklace I'm wearing when Katie is giving a speech on campus promoting world peace. It was under threat in 1937 because of the Spanish Civil War. Katie is an idealist who is president of the Young Communist League, the YCL, at a time when many progressive thinkers were attracted by communism's support of workers' rights and the utopian concept of a more equal society. Her skeptical classmates are heckling her. I often felt like an outcast growing up, so that seemed completely natural to me. And that's my own vintage Dusty Rose sweater I have on in the library, where I'm sneaking looks at Hubble in between studying. Once again, in this movie, I'm the unconventional-looking woman in love with the handsome prince. Hubble, star athlete, the big man on campus. Everything comes so easily to him, even writing, compared to Katie, who agonizes over her short story and is so hard on herself like I can be. When Hubble's story gets chosen to be read aloud in class, she's so devastated that she tears up her own and throws it in the trash. I needed to cry in that scene, but for some reason I couldn't. So Sidney just took me aside and put his arms around me, and that was all I needed. I completely broke down. It was so exciting to come to work every morning with actors and a director whom I respected. If you were stuck, Sidney could give you that little trigger. He spoke the actor's language, or with that simple touch, no words were necessary. When Katie runs into Hubble at El Morocco, she hasn't seen him since he cut in on Frank Mivet, her colleague from the YCL, to dance with her at their senior prom. Now it's 1944. The world is at war. He's in the Navy. She's working at a radio station. And Hubble, who's had too much to drink, is in no shape to go anywhere by himself, so she has to bring him home with her. While she's making coffee, he falls asleep in her bed. Katie stares at him, quietly takes off her dress and her slip, and slides in to join him. She can't quite believe she's lying next to this man she's had a crush on for so long. Delicately, she touches his hair, and he moves closer, kissing her neck, and then begins to make love to her, automatically, because he's basically asleep. You may think this is the kind of scene that comes naturally. You don't have to act, just be in the moment. But in fact, it's always difficult for me. I'm a very private person, and it's hard to be intimate when other people are watching. It's awkward and scary, and in this case, my own emotions blended into Katie's. I'm thinking she doesn't want him to stop, but she's almost afraid to react. Would that break the spell? And then she's experiencing all the usual doubts. Will she disappoint him? Will he disappoint her? Because if he wakes up, then what? All these emotions are playing across her face, but at the end, her fleeting smile dissolves when she says, "Hubble, it's Katie." You did know it was Katie, and a tear falls from her eye. Hubble doesn't remember a thing the next morning, or at least pretends not to. Bob is great in that scene. All he wants to do is get out of there gracefully. He doesn't even stay to eat the breakfast Katie has prepared for him. But when he comes back to town and calls to take her up on her offer of a place to sleep, Katie uses all her ration stamps to buy food for him. Well, she's Jewish. She's coming home, laden with groceries, and catches him just as he's leaving, blurting out, "I've got steaks and baked potatoes and sour cream and chives and salad and fresh baked pie. I would have made a pot roast. I make a terrific pot roast, but I didn't know whether you'd ever had pot roast or whether you liked pot roast. I mean, anyway, there wasn't time because it should be made the day before. You've got to stay for supper. That's all there is to it." Redford says, "What kind of pie?" with the emphasis on pie, I thought maybe the emphasis should be on kind. In other words, it's the right kind of pie. He'll stay. I thought it would be funnier and more charming if Hubble were more amused by her. And that prompted me to ask Bob, would you ever let me direct you? Yeah, I would, he said, which really pleased me and represented a big leap of faith on his part because I hadn't directed anything at this point. Hubble does stay for supper, just because Katie has guilted him into it. It's only when she pulls out his novel after the meal and tells him honestly what she thinks of it that he's truly intrigued. Katie believes in him, but she's also unafraid to tell him where his book falls short, and that's the real beginning of their romance. People often fall in love with their teacher, mentors, someone who cares enough to push them to be their best. There's a beautiful sequence where he's looking at her as if seeing her for the first time. They're touching each other, and then they make love in front of the fire. In Arthur's original script, Hubble leans over her and says, "It'll be better this time." So he did remember that they had made love that first night. But the line was cut. I'm not sure why. Perhaps Sidney thought it made Hubble less likable. But to me, it was so much more interesting if Hubble acknowledged his earlier behavior and subtly apologized for it. I thought Sidney's staging of the breakup scene at the radio station was so smart, with Katie and Hubble initially separated by the glass wall of the booth. Hubble says, "Look, Katie," and she interrupts him, "Oh, God, please don't start a sentence with look. It's always bad news." He tells her their relationship isn't working, and she thinks she knows why. "I don't fit on Beekman Place. That's what's really wrong." She doesn't want Hubble to see her cry, so she turns her back on him for a moment until she can compose herself. But he puts down her key and walks out. In the next scene, Sidney had me calmly taking Hubble's jacket out of the closet and neatly folding it into a suitcase. Then I carefully gather up his manuscript pages and close his typewriter case, tilting my head back to try to hold in the tears. I remember that day very clearly. My first instinct as an actress and as a woman was that Katie would be angry. As I know from experience, when you're profoundly hurt, you often react with anger to cover up the pain. I would have liked to try having her grab his clothes out of the closet and throw them in the suitcase, pull his shaving cream out of the medicine cabinet and dump it in the wastebasket, rip his page out of the typewriter and slam the case shut. In the photo, director Sidney Pollack, on set with his stars. But Sidney saw it differently. He wanted me to be sad and teary, so that's what I did. Looking at the scene again, Sidney's way definitely works, especially once it was underscored with Marvin Hamlisch's beautiful music. But I was also thinking of the film as a whole and worried about having three scenes in a row with tears. Since in the next scene, where Katie calls Hubble on the phone, she can't stop crying. That's another reason why I felt some anger would have been a better lead-in to that scene. I mentioned that there were five scenes that I loved in the treatment, and the telephone scene is one of them, and it was there right from the beginning, almost word for word. I think it's one of Arthur's best pieces of writing. I didn't have to prepare before we shot it. I didn't want to discuss it. I didn't even want to rehearse it. I just wanted to do it. The words alone always moved me. You just say them and you cry. Katie dials the phone, and the first thing she says when Hubble answers is, "It's me." The tears started immediately. I put my hand over my face and ad-libbed something. "Hubble, wait a minute. Hold on a minute. Don't go away." While I pulled a handkerchief out of my pocket, I must have asked them to give me a handkerchief, because I knew this scene was going to make me cry. I just didn't know where or when. "Listen, Hubble, this is kind of peculiar. I know that I don't have to apologize for what I said, because I know that you know. Anyway, the peculiar thing is, it's really a request, a favor. See, I can't sleep, Hubble. And it would help me so much if you could, well, if I had someone to talk to, you know, if I had a best friend or something to talk about it with. Only you're my best friend. Isn't that dumb? It's so dumb. I heard my voice going up an octave. You're the best friend I've ever had. I love that idea. He's her best friend, and she has nobody else she can talk to about him, except him. That felt so true. And it would help me so much if you could just come over and see me through tonight. Listen, Hubble, I promise I won't touch you or beg you or embarrass you, but I've got to talk to my best friend about someone we both know. We did two takes of the scene. On the first, I was oblivious to the camera. I wasn't in control of my voice or my tears, and I certainly wasn't paying any attention to the mechanics of the shot. But on the second, I remember thinking, why is the camera staying so far away during this long speech? I've always been able to feel the camera as it's moving in, and the closer it comes, the less I do, just instinctively. But that didn't happen here, so I just kept sobbing. And now all I can think is, why do I keep holding that handkerchief in front of my face? I was probably self-conscious about my nose running. This is painful to watch. I can't believe how long my hand is in front of my face. You can't see the eyes. You can hear the emotion, but you can't see it. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes that's great, but not here. This is where I needed Sydney to say, Barbara, I want you to try it without the handkerchief this time, or pick it up, then put it down. I don't care if your nose runs. In his memoir, Arthur says, how I wished I could have directed her in that phone call. There was no reason for her to hide her face. Barbara Streisand understood rejection. What she needed was help from someone who understood her. Arthur blamed Sydney and said it was never reshot, and if done properly, it would have won her the Academy Award. I didn't want to believe that. But now that I'm looking at my performance here, I'm thinking it's not good enough. I was so eager to do this scene that I couldn't help myself. All the emotion just overflowed. I should have put that handkerchief down, and I should have done less. To see Katie trying to control her emotions would have been more heartbreaking. Again, it's the restraint that moves you. I wish I could do it over. Sydney was an actor himself. He understood how important this moment could be. If only he had slowed me down, done a few more takes to give me the time to calm down a bit, asked me to try it a different way. This is difficult to write about. I adored Sydney. We used to tell each other secrets. Mine went with him to the grave, and I would never tell his, and I trusted him to do what was best for the film. But I think he felt responsible for persuading Redford to do the movie, even though I had the more showy part, and perhaps, subconsciously, he was trying to redress the balance by paying less attention to some of Katie's most important scenes. I just assumed Sydney would protect me as an actress. But maybe he was more protective of Redford. I never realized it until watching the movie now. Arthur, in his own memoir, recounted what he said to Sydney. You're going to build out Redford's part because he's the blonde goy you wish you were. The picture is Barbara's no matter what you do, because the story is hers. Be careful you don't destroy it trying to give it to him. Arthur could be very cruel, and I think he's too harsh on Sydney. For me, the story became more compelling when Katie and Hubble were more evenly matched. That's how we know they're meant for each other, and that's what makes it so moving when Hubble does come to see her after the call, and she asks why they can't be together. He says, because you push too hard, every damn minute. There's no time, ever, to just relax and enjoy living. He's right. Katie does push too hard, encouraging him to finish his book, but only because she believes in him so deeply. And that's what finally wins him over. Katie, you expect so much. Oh, but look what I've got. In the next scene, they're on a sailboat, with the Malibu coastline in the background. Then we see Katie setting a bride and groom cake topper on a shelf in their beach house. So we know they're married, and they've moved to L.A., and it's all done without words, in a few shots. Nice work, Sydney. Bob loved to tease me, just as Hubble teases Katie. I think the most fun we had was shooting the party scene where everybody is dressed up as a Marx brother. I was Harpo, Bob was Groucho, and the real Groucho Marx even stopped by the set to visit. His costume was definitely the best. When Katie's about to start a fight with the director, who's making a movie of Hubble's book, Bob clapped his hand over my mouth. Of all the ways in my life that people have tried to shut me up, that was by far the funniest. But for me, the most interesting moments to play were when the story suddenly turned from light to serious on a dime. There's a scene where Katie is cooking, dreaming about moving to France so Hubble can finish his novel there. He quickly changes the subject to ask about her job. She summarizes books for the movie studio. Katie describes a phony synopsis she wrote just to entertain herself. You see, there's this kibbutz of Chinese Jews living in a rice paddy, and she cooks communist rice paddies. They laugh, and then she says she's got another one for him. Loudmouth Jewish girl from New York City comes to Malibu, California, and tells her gorgeous, goyish guy that she's pregnant. Bob's reaction is perfect. Hubble is speechless for a moment, and then embraces her, gently. He's so happy. The fact that they're going to have a baby brings them closer. On another evening at the director's house, we see them slow dancing all by themselves. That's so much sexier to me than something more obvious, like a kiss. Then the movie turns on a dime again, when the director finds a wire behind a Picasso painting, and all the guests are shocked to realize their conversation is being taped. Arthur was dealing with a subject that few filmmakers were willing to touch, the way the government, afraid of communism, focused on Hollywood in 1947 and summoned various directors, writers, actors, and producers to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Most people, when they were questioned about supposed subversives, named names, but the Hollywood Ten refused to answer, and for their integrity they were blacklisted, which meant they could no longer work. Careers were cut short. Lives were ruined. Arthur was blacklisted himself, so this story was very personal to him. Unfortunately, a lot of that story didn't make the final cut. Katie plans to travel to Washington in support of the Hollywood Ten, even though Hubble doesn't want her to go. He's angry. He pours a drink and says, "We're kind of back where we started, aren't we?" "That's not true, Hubble," she replies. Originally, there was more to Katie's speech. She went on to say, "In college, I stood under a maple tree selling Loyalist Spain, and you wouldn't let Jews into your fraternity house. Now you've married one, and she's going to have your baby. We live on the beach in Malibu, California, and that is not where we started." It was a subtle indictment of prejudice and a confirmation of their own bond, but it was cut, and the rest of the sequence, where she explains why she can't sit back while their friends are in jeopardy, is also missing. Katie is a political animal. Hubble is not. Politics and the conflict it caused is glossed over with that cut. Arthur could telegraph a lifetime of emotion in a few words. Not that everything he wrote was perfect. When I heard about early versions of the story, where Hubble has an affair with the director's wife, the director comes on to Katie, Katie comes on to a tennis pro, I thought all that was ridiculous. It diluted the central romance and made Hubble very unappealing, which doesn't work in a love story, because you need the audience to be rooting for both people. But the essence of Arthur's story was amazing, and that's what I kept fighting for through all the many rewrites he did and the various fixes made by other writers. The fact is, Sydney didn't like Arthur, That's why he brought in his own writers. And Arthur didn't like Sidney. So I acted as the intermediary. I'd call Sidney at night to talk about a scene and read him some lines from an earlier version, hoping to reinstate Arthur's words. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, because Sidney had his own vision, and I thought some of the choices he made in the edit were very good. He cut the scene where Katie sees Hubble go off with his old college girlfriend and instead lets the audience know that she knows much more, subtly, in the projection room scene. After watching his not-so-good movie, everyone skips out except Katie and Hubble. He mocks a comment from one of their friends, and when Katie defends her, he says, "Katie, the day you die, you'll still be a nice Jewish girl." "Are you still a nice Gentile boy?" she asks, taking the conversation in a whole new direction. "I never was," he replies, and continues, "Katie, what's wrong with us has nothing to do with another girl. Oh, give up, please." "I can't. I hate what you did to your book." That's more upsetting to her than a one-night stand, which disturbs her but would never break them up. "I hate the picture. I hate those people. I hate the palm trees. I wish it would rain. Oh, I want... What? I want us to love each other." Arthur had written one more line to that scene. Hubble says, "We do. That's the trouble, Katie. We do." I have no idea why Sidney cut that line. Maybe he was trying to avoid complexities. Me, I look for them. But now, to the most devastating loss, it never even occurred to me that Sidney would take out two major scenes, the crux of the film, in my opinion, two of the five great scenes that I loved in Arthur's treatment. The first takes place after the scene in the projection room. It's another day. Katie is on her way home with groceries, and as she's driving through the UCLA campus, she sees a girl making a speech. A small crowd is gathering, and she pulls up and stops the car to listen. The girl is telling the students that they must support members of the faculty who refuse to take a loyalty oath. She says, "The witch hunters have already begun to blacklist our teachers, to put informers in our classrooms, our laboratories." I remember shooting this scene as though it were yesterday, a scene that I thought was the very definition of the title, "The Way We Were." I liked the way Sidney had set up the camera to capture my reactions in one shot. What hit me first as Katie was how much this student reminded me of my younger self in college, speaking out about the Spanish Civil War. I'm smiling. My God, did I look like that? Did I sound like that? Were my clothes equally pathetic? But then the camera moves in gradually as my emotions turn. The girl is earnest and sincere, and she's getting heckled by the crowd, as Katie had been. I knew exactly what she was going through, and my eyes welled up with tears. I'm thinking, what has become of me? Where is that girl I once was, trying to save the world, ready to fight injustice? And now I've sold my soul, spending my time writing synopses of stupid books. By the end of the push-in, I'm sobbing. I did it in one take because the situation was so right. I could already imagine the finished scene in the movie. Marvin's beautiful theme would start playing under the girl's voice, and the snide comments from the crowd, and Katie's reaction would have even more impact because it would happen in a single shot. I couldn't wait to see the dailies because I thought it had gone so well. Since I didn't work the next day, they arranged a screening for me, and I was sitting by myself when that scene came up. There was the picture, but there was no sound. What happened? It turned out that the sound man had asked Sidney, "Does she have any lines?" Sidney said no, so the guy went on to the next location. This meant I would have to loop the crying to somehow recreate the emotion in a recording booth. Why didn't Sidney keep the sound man? It probably was an honest mistake, but still, this was an important scene. Much later, when Sidney came to my house to show me the rough cut of the movie, I was dumbfounded by the way this scene had been edited. It went from the shot of me driving up to a small crowd gathering around this girl, then cut to me crying. You can't do that. Where's the transition? Sidney said the push-in was too long, but I timed it, and it was just a few seconds. Now it looked like two totally different takes, and the switch was not believable. He cut out the few frames in between, cut out how one emotion turned into another, and diminished the impact of what she was going through. And then, in the final film, Sidney ended up cutting out the scene entirely. I was stunned. Here was a moment that shook Katie to her very core. It made her stop and think about her past and reassess her future. This was her epiphany. It was such a critical scene, and the whole sequence was less than a minute. I was so disappointed. I missed this scene so much because it worked not just emotionally, but also structurally. After their blow-up in the projection room, I felt that Katie and Hubble needed time away from each other. Arthur had written the scene for Katie at UCLA, and Alvin and David added a good scene for Hubble on a boat to balance that. He's with his best friend, JJ, and they're playing their favorite game, reminiscing about the past. And JJ asks, "Best year?" Hubble answers, "Best year, 1944? No, 1945, 46. He's thinking back to the time when he and Katie were first together. It's a subtle way to indicate that he still loves her, and it was so right to have them both remembering the way they were. Then, in the next scene, Katie and Hubble come together in their Malibu living room about to eat dinner. This is the second scene that I couldn't believe was cut from the film. Hubble stands there, fiddling with a corkscrew, when he suddenly asks, "Who is Frank McVeigh?" Katie is surprised. "Frank McVeigh? Old Frankie? We went to college with him. At least I did. We were in the YCL together. Why?" "He informed on you." "He what?" She sits down, stunned. "The little rat. It's so crazy. He was my date at the senior prom, and you cut in for 10 seconds. I guess it was obvious I liked you better than him. What could he tell them anyway? I mean, I left the party during the war, for God's sake." Frankie had been jealous of Katie's attraction to Hubble all those years ago, and now he finally got even. It's so human. It's often something petty that prompts people to do terrible things. The next lines Arthur wrote were never filmed. Katie asked Hubble what the committee could possibly accuse her of having done. "They say you tried to get the studio to make a subversive film." "I what?" "You recommended a book which they claim was outright propaganda for communist China." And then she starts to laugh, because she realizes he's talking about her phony synopsis about the Chinese kibbutz and the communist rice paddies. "I tried to get those lines back in, but Sidney said no one would believe it, that it was too ridiculous." Arthur always said that the climax of the picture was when the love story and the political story came together. And this is the scene where it happened. In 1947, as far as the studio was concerned, Katie was subversive. And if Hubble, who was employed by the studio, had a subversive wife, that was grounds to fire him. Frankie's betrayal means that Katie will be called before the committee and expected to name names. Katie says, "Hubble, there is no justification for informing, none. And there's something very wrong with any country that makes for informers." "Christ, is that what you think I want you to do?" he answers. What a great line. This is where we see Hubble's strength of character and his love and support for Katie. I don't know. All I know is that if I don't name names, you can't get a job in this town. "Okay," he says, "then I'll have to finish my book." So he's not going to ask her to compromise her values. He brings over their plates and says, "Let's eat." Katie sits down on the sofa, stares off into the distance, and says, "It's amazing how decisions are forced on you willy-nilly." She looks at Hubble. "You never did want to finish your book, did you?" "I don't know. I guess I never really thought there was much point." "And you never really wanted to go to France, did you?" "No, I didn't. You wanted me to." And now we see her strength of character, because she's willing to sacrifice what means the most to her, her marriage, in order to save him. She says, "If we got a divorce, you wouldn't have a subversive wife, and that would solve everything, wouldn't it?" "No," Hubble answers, "no, it wouldn't." But Katie has already decided, and she knows it's the only decision, the proper decision, because she is not going to name names, and she does not want him to be punished for her beliefs. They have come to a crossroads, and she finds herself reminiscing, "Wouldn't it be lovely if we were old? We'd have survived all this, and everything would be easy and uncomplicated, the way it was when we were young. Katie, it was never uncomplicated." "But it was lovely, wasn't it?" "Yes, it was lovely," he says. Which leads to that heartbreaking line, "Will you do me one favor, Hubble? Will you stay with me till the baby's born?" It's precisely because she loves him deeply that she makes the decision to let him go. And it's also about being true to herself. She can't stay in Hollywood, but she knows that Hubble, to the contrary, belongs there. And there's a whole other layer to her decision as she suddenly confronts a truth about their relationship. She's been pushing him all these years to be something he doesn't want to be, to live somewhere he doesn't want to live, to write something he doesn't want to write. She's been assuming that Hubble shares her vision of him, but the reality is he's afraid he can't live up to it. As he said to her back in New York when they first broke up, "You expect so much." That's been a huge pressure on him, and she finally hears what he's been saying all along, and now she understands. So she releases him, and there's strength and love and generosity in her response, because it's incredibly painful to her. Almost none of this is left in the film. What we see instead is Hubble setting down their plates on a table as the scene begins with Katie's line, "It's amazing how decisions are forced on you willy-nilly." What decision? The line makes no sense. We have no idea what she's talking about, because the Frankie McVeigh scene has been cut, and it's the climax of the story. The fact that Katie has been informed on is the catalyst for everything that happens next. Without that scene and the UCLA scene, the plot is eviscerated, and we've lost the essence of her character, as well as his, because Hubble's lines show he was prepared to stand by her. Without those two crucial scenes, there's nothing about her feeling that she has lost her sense of self in Hollywood. Nothing about being informed on. Nothing about what actually forced her decision. All of that is gone. So now you think they split up simply because he shtooped this other girl one time. You can hear Sydney on the documentary describing how they previewed the picture on a Friday night in San Francisco, and it was a flop. Then he says that he took out about five scenes, and they were all politics. And on Saturday night, the picture was a hit. By the way, my manager, Marty Ehrlichman, was there, and he says the picture played great on both nights. I agreed with Sydney on three of those scenes. They involved subsidiary characters having political discussions that went on so long even I lost interest. Yes, right, cut those extraneous scenes, about 15 minutes. No great loss. But don't cut the two scenes that were pivotal to the plot. Don't cut the crucial 3.5 minutes that the whole film revolves around. It was such a betrayal of Arthur's story. It destroyed the soul of Katie's character and destroyed me. I was so upset back in 1973 that I asked if I could have the deleted scenes, and I've kept those trims in my vault, along with outtakes from my recordings, TV specials, and certain films. Then in 1998, when we were doing the DVD for the 25th anniversary, I asked Sidney if I could show those deleted scenes in the documentary. He could easily have said no, but instead he very generously said okay, because he understood how passionate I was about this movie. That was Sidney being a real friend. In the documentary, both Arthur and I talk about how those cuts eliminated vital information. Sidney admits, "I don't say to this day that I'm right. The fact is, Ray Stark and the studio were pushing him to take out the politics because they thought it would bore people." As Sidney explained to one journalist, "We were getting so much pressure. Columbia was going under at the time. They hadn't had a big hit in years, and the picture was going over budget. Bob didn't get along with Ray Stark, and neither did I. We didn't know how to mix the politics and the love story and make it work." Ray was nervous. Arthur writes in his book that Ray told Sidney to make those cuts after the first San Francisco preview. So, Sidney and Margaret Booth, Ray's favorite editor, a tough woman from another era, went up into the projection booth with a razor blade and cut the film hastily in one chunk. And in my humble opinion, they threw out the baby with the bathwater. I took my pleas to Ray, which was useless. I felt absolutely powerless. My mind just flashed back to that moment as a young girl, standing in my mother's bedroom doorway and being ignored. Once again, I felt unseen and unheard. I begged Sidney to put those two scenes back in, but he didn't. That was the moment when I thought, that's it. I had always had creative control of my albums, my TV specials, and my concerts. Now I realized I have to be more in control of my films as well. I have to direct. Of course, it's hard to argue with success. The movie became a huge hit, and Columbia's second highest grossing film up till then. They told me the highest was Funny Girl. The Way We Were was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, but I thought there was something odd when I saw the list. No nomination for Best Picture. Sidney wasn't nominated as Best Director. Arthur wasn't nominated for his screenplay. Maybe the reason the movie missed out on the big awards was because people sensed something was missing and didn't understand why Katie and Hubble broke up. Several critics pointed out gaps in the storyline. Roger Ebert said, "Inexplicably, the movie suddenly and implausibly has them fall out of love, and they split up without resolving anything, particularly the plot." I was honored to be nominated for Best Actress, but I was very disappointed that Bob wasn't nominated for Best Actor for our movie because he was amazing in it. He did get nominated for The Sting. At least The Way We Were was up for Best Original Song, and the Academy asked me to sing it on the broadcast, but I was reluctant. My stage fright again. When I get nervous, my heart pounds, and it affects my voice, which starts to shake, and I lose control. It's a terrible feeling, and I didn't want to go through that. So they asked Peggy Lee to do it, which was fine with me, because I wanted to be thought of as an actress first, not a singer. But in retrospect, I wish I had been stronger and sung the song. And now, in reliving this time in my life, I realize that my emotions were more conflicted than I could even admit to myself back then. And that's probably why I didn't want to go to the ceremony. I felt embarrassed that crucial parts of the performance were not even in the movie. I just couldn't bear the thought of sitting in that auditorium and having to smile for the cameras and pretend everything was great. So I hid backstage. Frankly, I was relieved when they didn't call my name. The winner was Glenda Jackson for A Touch of Class, but she wasn't in the audience either, so at least I wasn't the only one. The only people from our movie who went home with Oscars that night were Marvin for the score and the music for the song, and Alan and Marilyn Bergman for the lyrics. I know the song contributed enormously to the movie's success, yet Sidney told me that Redford didn't want me to sing at all. Bob confirmed this on Oprah in 2010 when he surprised me by showing up to reminisce. Maybe he didn't realize how seamlessly Sidney and Marvin would integrate the song into the movie to the extent that they're irrevocably linked to this day. Like the film, the song was a huge hit. In addition to the Oscar, it won the Golden Globe Award for Best Original Song and the Grammy Award for Song of the Year. And the way Marvin used it in the last scene was particularly moving. Sidney and I flew back together to New York to shoot it, and it was time well spent, because I managed to convince him to put back more of Arthur's words. The scene starts with a shot of the iconic Plaza Hotel. Then we see Katie walking toward it. She spots Hubble at the entrance. He spots her and does a double take. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.